Today is Thursday, September the 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. California Governor Gavin Newsom on Tuesday defeated a recall election aimed at removing him from office early.
I'm humbled and grateful to the millions and millions of Californians that exercise their fundamental right to vote and express themselves so overwhelmingly by rejecting the division, by rejecting the cynicism.
In South and North Korea, both test-launched ballistic missiles hours apart from each other. And the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is calling for a moratorium on the sale and use of artificial intelligence systems.
With documented cases of erroneous identification and disproportionate impacts on certain groups, often minorities.
And Tanzania's first female president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, has named a woman as defense minister. We have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story in the U.S., religious exemption requests are growing as COVID-19 vaccine mandates rise. AP correspondent Walter Ratliff has more.
Injections are becoming a much more widely used loophole against the COVID-19 shot. This includes about 3,000 Los Angeles Police Department employees and hundreds of Washington state workers seeking religious exemptions to the vaccine. The exemptions often involve the long-time role that cell lines derived from fetal tissue have played in the research and development of various vaccines. Roman Catholic leaders in New Orleans and St. Louis called COVID-19 shots morally compromised, but the Vatican has said it is acceptable for Catholics to receive COVID-19 vaccines. I'm Walter Ratliff.
And California Governor Gavin Newsom on Tuesday defeated a recall election aimed at removing him from office early. Governor Newsom framed the recall election as part of a national battle for his party's values in the face of the coronavirus pandemic and continued threats from Trumpism.
Democrat Gavin Newsom decisively defeated efforts to boot him from office. He won Tuesday's recall race, which was fueled by his COVID restrictions. But he says that wasn't the only issue on the ballot.
Economic justice, social justice, racial justice, environmental justice, our values, where California's made so much progress, all of those things.
If Newsom had lost the recall election, Republican Larry Elder almost certainly would have been governor.
We may have lost the battle, but we are going to win the war.
What now? Governor Newsom has been mentioned as a possible presidential candidate, and there's speculation that Elder could be in the running again in California. I'm Rita Foley.
In the U.S., the nation's top military officer is defending phone calls to his Chinese counterpart during the Trump administration's final days. AP Washington correspondent Saga Megani.
An upcoming book by The Washington Post's Bob Woodward and Robert Costa describes Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley as worried about what Trump might do before leaving office and telling China's top officer he would warn Beijing in case of a U.S. attack. Milley's spokesman says the general was acting within his duties as the president's top uniformed advisor. Trump says Milley should be tried for treason if the report's true. At the White House, President Biden was asked if the Joint Chiefs chair did the right thing.
I have great confidence in General Milley.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Earlier this year, Lebanese troops thwarted an attempt to smuggle dozens of Syrian migrants to the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. However, it appears now that Syrian migrants are less of an issue. Instead, hundreds of Lebanese migrants are moving to Cyprus as they did during the 1975 to 1990 civil war. Most are leaving due to the economic crisis in the country. From Beirut, reporter George Eid has more.
After Lebanon's drastic economic collapse and increasing financial strains, more and more Lebanese are leaving home. The Gulf and the USA are popular destinations, but the first choice for many Lebanese is Lebanon's neighboring island, Cyprus. Cyprus Made, a local newspaper in Cyprus, reported that there is a huge increase in Lebanese who chose Cyprus as their new residence. Rabia Kastoun, who owns a company in Lebanon, has decided to take up residence on the island this month. He explained to VOA from Larnaca that working from Lebanon became impossible lately due to the frequent electric cuts.
Basically, for the past 2 years, it has been almost impossible to work in Lebanon with all the interruption, the internet and other services, the lack of energy and power. So we had a lot of handicaps that keep us to be able to work and deliver our project on time facing this. I opted to move to Cyprus, where the infrastructure is well developed, the internet speed and services are up to the scale of the EU, in order to continue outsourcing for foreign countries. Especially that Lebanon is going through an economic crisis, Cyprus is a business-friendly environment with a lot of incentive for new businesses.
Many Lebanese have already established new businesses in Cyprus. Others have invested in real estate. But for some, it was easier to relocate their business to the island. Elias Karim, who runs one of the biggest companies in Lebanon specializing in outdoor and indoor decorations, has established his base in Cyprus a few months back. He says to VOA that the economic meltdown was the main reason that pushed him to leave Lebanon.
After 17 years of active presence, we were one of the pioneers in this field in the Lebanese market with an extensive portfolio. But due to the economic crisis that hit Lebanon around a year and a half ago, and as a result of the fast fall of all public and private sectors, all this triggered us to act straight away and try to find an immediate and appropriate alternative. And Cyprus was our first, fastest, and best choice, since it was the nearest EU country with a simple incorporation process and a moderate relocation cost.
Cyprus, which is only 30 minutes flights away from Beirut, had been a safe haven for the Lebanese fleeing the atrocities of the Lebanese civil war that spanned from 1975 until 1990. The island welcomed in those years about 100,000 Lebanese families. Today, analysts estimate the number of Lebanese seeking refuge in Cyprus to be more than that, as the economic crisis continues to make life in Lebanon unbearable. This is George Age reporting for VOA from Beirut.
North Korea test-fired two short-range ballistic missiles Wednesday. It is the North's second major launch in less than a week. It is also Pyongyang's latest apparent attempt to pressure the United States amid stalled nuclear talks, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
After about 6 months of relative silence, North Korea this week made big headlines. On Monday, it announced a cruise missile test. 2 days later, it tested a pair of ballistic missiles. To many analysts, the moves suggest North Korea is trying to increase its bargaining leverage with the United States. The North has often raised tensions before engaging in talks. Bong Young-sik is a professor at Seoul's Yonsei University. He says North Korea may have decided to raise its provocations in order to get Washington's attention.
North Korea is expressing its discontent toward the Biden administration, which has remained in a very passive policy toward North Korea in the name of cautious and calibrated North Korea policy.
While U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed a willingness to resume North Korea talks, much of the U.S. focus has been elsewhere, such as the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and efforts to fight COVID-19. Some analysts say Pyongyang may feel ignored. The tests were timed for maximum pressure. The North's latest launch coincided with a visit to Tokyo by Sung Kim, the U.S. Special Envoy to North Korea. He's meeting with his counterparts from South Korea and Japan. On Tuesday, the U.S. Envoy repeated Washington's offer to restart talks without preconditions. But analyst Park Won-gan says those types of statements do not appear to have satisfied North Korea, since the United States has refused to relax sanctions. For most of the year, South Korea has focused on domestic problems. It has suffered major floods and a heat wave. It's also continuing one of the world's strictest COVID-19 lockdowns. Because of those pressures, some analysts expect North Korea may refrain from major provocations, such as a nuclear test, that would risk bringing further economic and diplomatic isolation. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
In Russia, the country is preparing for parliamentary and local elections on Sunday in what the opposition says is an atmosphere of repression in which a number of candidates not aligned with the ruling party have been excluded. John Spear narrates this report from Ricardo Makina in Moscow.
Analysts call these elections crucial, with the ruling United Russia party aiming to maintain its overwhelming majority in the State Duma, the Russian parliament. The poll follows months of pressure against the liberal and democratic opposition in the streets and against independent media on the internet, something that has political activists deeply pessimistic. Among them is Vladimir Kara-Murza, a prominent opponent of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It's even debatable if we can speak about the opposition in Russia. You know, opposition is a term that's associated with democracies. Oppositions usually sit in parliaments or in television studios, can participate in elections. In our country today, the key opponents of this regime are either dead, imprisoned, or exiled.
Popular support for Putin remains notably high, with a Levada Center survey finding he has a 65% approval rating. The political struggle for seats in parliament is between Putin's party and the communists or nationalist radicals, parties that many independent observers say are considered systemic or a facade to maintain the democratic image of the country. Anton Orek is a political analyst. We have got currently both communists, LDPR and Fair Russia, in the Duma. Has Duma become a venue for discussions? No, for a long time. No, for already several sessions. Despite the pressure against candidates who are critical of the government, the only hope for the opposition is with the liberal parties, such as Yabloko, the Democratic Party, and some independent candidates who have managed to participate in these elections. Political analyst Boris Kargalinsky says they remain the opposition's only voice when so many others have been silenced.
The only positive thing about elections is campaigning, because no matter how they count, and even no matter how we vote, because it doesn't count. And the important thing is that you at least can speak up.
Concerns about possible fraud are widespread. The opposition hopes for a massive turnout as the best defense against any attempts to rig the vote. Kirill Goncharov of the Yabloko party. If they try to do that, the legitimacy of the Duma will be equal to zero. That is why it is required to mobilize our supporters despite everything. But early indications point to a low voter turnout. With few opposition candidates running and voter apathy generally high, big political changes in Russia appear to be unlikely this time around. For Ricardo Marquina in Moscow, John Speer, VOA News.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is calling for a moratorium on the sale and use of intelligence systems, which she says pose a serious threat and risk to human rights. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The High Commissioner's report, which will be submitted to the UN Human Rights Council, provides an analysis of how advances in digital technologies are affecting people's human rights. The report argues that artificial intelligence, or AI, can be a force for good, but also can be overly intrusive and have negative, even catastrophic effects on persons' right to privacy and other human rights. Peggy Hicks is the director of thematic engagement at the UN Human Rights Office. She says AI systems can be faulty and have embedded biases. These, she says, can lead to discrimination that might jeopardize job prospects and the denial of welfare and social security benefits. She says there are numerous cases of people being treated unjustly because of the faulty use of AI in the law enforcement, national security, and criminal justice and border management areas.
Where we see AI being used for profiling and suspect identification, biometric technologies such as facial recognition and emotional recognition being used, including remotely and real time, to identify people, with documented cases of erroneous identification and disproportionate impacts on certain groups, often minorities.
The report notes biometric technologies increasingly are being used by governments, international organizations, and technology companies to identify people in real time and from a distance. This potentially allows unlimited tracking of individuals. Hicks says the High Commissioner specifically recommends a moratorium on the use of remote biometric recognition technology in public places, given the serious threats to public freedoms associated with such surveillance.
Without immediate and far-reaching shifts in how we address AI deployment and development, the existing harms will multiply at scale and with speed. And the worst part of it is, we won't even know the extent of the problem because there is so little transparency around artificial intelligence and its use.
Human Rights Chief Bachelet says there needs to be much greater transparency by companies and states in how they are developing and using AI. She says the power of AI to serve people is undeniable, but so is its ability to invade their privacy and violate human rights on an enormous scale and with virtually no visibility. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other headline news, Trinidad and Tobago Health Minister Terence Dayalsing on Wednesday criticized as false the claim by American rapper Nicki Minaj that a person on the Caribbean island suffered swollen testicles after receiving a COVID-19 vaccine. Trinidad-born Minaj sparked an international furor when she alleged on Twitter that her cousin in Trinidad refuses to get a vaccine because his friend became impotent after being vaccinated. And Pope Francis has rejected the resignation of the Archbishop of Hamburg. He had offered to step down after a report named him among several senior officials in Germany's Catholic Church to have breached their duty in handling sexual abuse cases.
Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Now, with almost 50 million users, Kenya has one of the most engaged Twitter communities on the continent. Kenyans use the platform to take part in debate on various issues, including the recent high-profile court case regarding President Kenyatta's signature political reform project known as the Building Bridges Initiative, or BBI, which the courts declared as unconstitutional. However, a new report says that some of the debate on Twitter was pushed by Kenyan social media influencers paid by shadowy political operatives. Brian Obilo is a tech and society fellow at Mozilla Foundation. He's also co-writer of the report titled Inside the Shadowy World of Disinformation for Hire in Kenya. In part two of our two-part conversation, he tells me that he worries about the political future of Kenya if such malicious coordinated disinformation attacks replace legitimate online debate.
One thing that we also mentioned in the report is that a few verified accounts were being used to sort of help amplify these disinformation campaigns. And our verified accounts are very lucrative. And in some instances, our source told us that they were reaching out to people and renting out, or rather renting the verified accounts because it makes the chances of the disinformation campaigns trending to be much higher. So it's right.
And it looks legitimate for whoever is consuming the information that somebody who with a verified account is actually tweeting or saying something. Now, the Kenyan election is coming up next year. If you look back at some of these past elections in Kenya and the kind of chaos and sometimes violence, what worries you the most?
I think what worries me the most is after tracking the disinformation campaigns over a period of time, we started seeing another breed of disinformation campaigns that had a lot of, displayed a lot of elements of hate speech, a lot of elements of insightful language and stuff like that. And this is very dangerous, especially for a country that has a history of violence after every electoral elections. It's very, very concerning, and Twitter may have blood on its hands if it does not make sure that, you know, these disinformation campaigns are not amplified on its own platforms. So it's very dangerous because Kenyans are an easy group to incite, and we have seen it constantly where after elections we have violence because of incitement.
Now, somebody will say that only a small minority of Kenyans are on Twitter and that this is a platform that is available to only the elites and people in the cities, in the urban centers. And, you know, the majority of Kenyans are not on Twitter. And so there's nothing to be worried about. Can you talk to us about some of the impact of these campaigns and how they're able to move from these little echo chambers or, you know, information silos to bigger greater demographics, greater numbers, building upon some of these disinformation?
One thing I can mention is that as much as we were doing this study with regards to disinformation on Twitter. Some of the graphics that contain disinformation, some of the videos, or rather some of the multimedia content that these groups created that contained disinformation was not only disseminated on Twitter, first of all. We saw some videos go viral on TikTok. And we also saw lots of these images and lots of these videos being disseminated on multiple Facebook groups. So as much as the disinformation may stem from Twitter, it has a ripple effect on other social media platforms. And at the same time, you understand how fast information spreads. And if millions of Kenyans already are getting this information on Twitter, then it means that they may also be spreading this information in other platforms or in other ways of communication that may not just be limited to social media alone. So when it comes to incitement, it may have a ripple effect in the whole country.
That was Brian Obilo, a cybersecurity engineer, currently a tech and society fellow at Mozilla Foundation, who specializes in cybersecurity, resilience, awareness, and disinformation. Brian is the co-writer of the recent report titled Inside the Shadowy World of Disinformation for Hire in Kenya. I reached him in Nairobi. For more of my conversation with Brian Obilo, head out to our program Upfront on the Voice of America, www.voanews.com. Let's go to West Africa, in the Gambia, where the National Transport Union called off a nationwide planned strike action. This followed intense negotiations between them and the government. The drivers have been complaining about a lack of garages, high fuel prices, and an unfair treatment at the ports of Banjul when it comes to queuing. They allege that foreign truckers from the West African sub-region are being accorded special treatment, denying them access to their own ports. Reporter Pande Ribai has been following this story and reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The government and the transport union have reached an agreement to put the strike on hold pending further negotiations to resolve the matter. A special task force has been constituted to review the new fare tariff increment proposed by the transport union. The union wants to introduce a 30% fare increment. Superintendent Laminjai is the spokesman for the Gambia Police Force.
Well, we understand that they have engagement with the Ministry of Interior, and so their demands have been looked into and a consensus has been made. And so as a result of that, they have called off the industrial action or a sit-down strike.
Travelers have been complaining about paying multiple fares while traveling from one town to the other, instead paying one fare. They have accused the drivers of exploitation and share greed. The drivers have cited high gas prices to justify their actions. According to spokesman Jai, the drivers have the following demands.
One of them, I think, is the increase of transport fares and also reduction of fuel prices. And I think also some issues such as the allocation of garages to them and also something to do with the queuing system at the port authority. So these are all outside stakeholder issues. And so they are meeting with the relevant stakeholders who are ready to have them resolved.
Njai says the drivers have since resumed work.
We know that after they have decided to call off the strike, a lot of vehicles have also returned to the road and they are applying their normal routine traffic as well.
Gerga Fall is the vice president of the Gambia General Transport Union.
Yo Gienarek, la minister bisimba minister of trade syndicate call ma president nako li ngeen bëgg pour queuing system bi am foreign queue.
He says shortly after their meeting with the Secretary General and head of the civil service, the trade minister called the president of the transport union, telling him that their demand on the issue of foreign truckers queuing at the port of Banjul was untenable. He says they were told by the minister that it is impossible for foreign truckers to join the queue at the ports. Fall says the minister's statement had contributed to their planned sit-down strike. He claimed that foreign truckers from Guinea-Bissau, Senegal, and Mali have been allowed to dominate sub-regional transportation at the expense of Gambian drivers. He says Gambian drivers have been taken out of business because of the foreign truckers. He alleged that the foreign truckers have been using the port of Banjul to evade taxes. He says goods that are meant to be transported to the sub-region are usually given tax waivers, but only to be uploaded in the Gambia. The transport union is demanding a reduction on toll crossing fees at the Senegambia bridge. They also want to have what they call an unhindered access to Senegal with Gambian commercial vehicles to be able to transport passengers to the former French colony without any form of blockage from the other side of the border. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Tanzania's first female president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, has named a woman as defense minister, the latest in a number of appointments of women to top government posts. Gender activists have welcomed the move, but they say more needs to be done to reduce Tanzania's gender inequality. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
The appointment came as part of the second cabinet reshuffle that President Samia Suluhu Hassan has made since the death of her predecessor, John Magufuli, earlier this year. At the inauguration of Tegumena Taxi as Tanzania's first female defense and national service minister, President Hassan said she made the choice to shatter the myth that women cannot serve in such a position.
Nimeamua kuvunja.
She said, I have decided to break the long-time myth that in the defense ministry, there shall be a man with muscles. The minister's job in that office is not to carry guns or artillery, President Hassan said. Her main duty, Hassan added, is to coordinate and manage the administration of policies at the ministry. Gender activists have welcomed the appointment, but said more needs to be done to address gender equality. Anna Henga heads the Legal and Human Rights Center. Henga says there must be an amendment of laws such as the Marriage Act and the Education Act, laws that put women in law decision positions. She added that the government should also allocate money through the Health Ministry to educate people that women can also be leaders. Analysts say an increase in the political representation of women at the national level does not automatically lead to women having more power in daily life, especially in highly stratified societies. Sociologist Nasoro Kitunda. Kitunda said, I think this tries to show that there is a direction in gender equality, though I'm not a believer in gender. The primary criteria, Kitunda added, should be someone's performance and their ability to implement those responsibilities. For Tanzanian human rights activist Aika Peter, appointing more women leaders is positive, but there must be a rotation to allow others to show their leadership skills.
We really need to see new faces when in his positions. You know, unapo ona.
Peter said, we really need to see new faces in these positions. When you see the same people being recycled every day, it gives the impression there are people who are so good at this job, there are no others who can be good at it. The latest appointment of defense minister brings the number of women who hold ministerial positions in President Hassan's government to 8. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day ahead.